The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made the start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. An exciting program, especially for those of you that like science and physics and astronomy and related topics. A couple of quick announcements first. If you would like to call and join our discussion, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Please do remember that this is the preferred way of communicating with the show and with our speakers and guests. But you can also use email, which is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Or you can post a comment on our blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming menu. And then this is the first show listed, so open it up. And comments and questions are down at the bottom. As soon as I receive a copy of your post, we can integrate it into our discussion today. But again, remember, we do prefer toll-free numbers, 1-866-687-7223. Also be sure to visit our website newsletter, and that is center right on our homepage, and it has been updated. So you'll see all of the program details for this week, plus you'll see all of the programs we're scheduling now through the end of 2018, and we're already scheduling quite a few toward the end of the year, so the year marches on. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen very quickly off of our website or very rapidly download the program. For those of you interested in Space Show logo wear, look in the upper left menu under support, and you'll find our store with Cafe Press. Also on that upper left menu is Listen Live, so this is important. Please share it with other people. But it tells you how to listen to live shows, compressed MP3 archives off of our website, and podcasts, including Alexa. To me, the most important part is supporting the Space Show. So remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with one, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And talking with a listener-supported program. That means that you keep it alive and going with your contributions, and we certainly do appreciate your support. Remember, as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you are paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. If you have questions, don't hesitate to contact me at drspace@thespaceshow.com or check out our nonprofit website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we certainly appreciate that. We are copyrighted and trademarked. You're free to download our shows and share them with people. However, it's easier just to send people the URL, much shorter. Keep in mind that there are a couple of rules about that. Don't do anything commercial. Don't edit the programs and put any edits or clips up on YouTube. And written transcripts are not permitted. If you do have a special use in mind, please email me. Let me know what it is. Send me the details. And I will check with our guest to see if what you want to do is okay with the guest as well as with the Space Show. And thank you for living by these simple rules. But they are very, very important, especially for protecting our guests so that they don't get taken out of context and turned into somebody else's agenda. And we have a really fascinating program with you today, and I know that because I've spoken to our guest several times before on the Space Show, Dr. Chris Impey, and he has a new book that I've been reading, which is very interesting, Einstein's Monsters, The Life and Times of Black Holes. And I think you're going to really enjoy this discussion as well as learn from it. Dr. Impey is a distinguished professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona, and he's a critically acclaimed author of several books, including Beyond, How It Began, and How It Ends. He's also written two astronomy textbooks. Dr. Impey, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm good. It's good to be with you again.
Thank you very much. Why a book on black holes? What inspired you for that?
Yeah, well, black holes have always been hot, if you like. I mean, people are always intrigued by them, and there are certainly still big research questions we haven't answered. I think the two extra things that motivated me for the book were, one, the detection of gravitational waves just a year or so ago, which sort of kicked that black holes into the front burner and pretty much proved that they exist. I mean, that those gravity waves could only have come from merging black holes. So that's given us a whole new way to look at black holes. And then the second was that any other books on black holes that I was aware of pretty much focused on the small ones, the ones that result from the death of massive stars, whereas nature has figured out how to make black holes that are billions of times more massive than that at the centers of galaxies, and that sort of got short shrift, and as far as I could tell, in the popular literature. So I wanted to talk about the full spectrum of black holes in one book.
So from what I have learned so far, science fiction doesn't really portray them very accurately either, I would say. Is that a pretty fair general assumption, especially the event horizon?
Yeah, there's sort of myths and tropes and sort of stereotypes about black holes that get trotted out over and over again. Probably the most ubiquitous one is that they're cosmic vacuum cleaners that just sweep up everything and suck up everything. And indeed, they, of course, do attract matter with their gravity, but the extreme distortions of space and time that they're notable for really only occur quite close to the event horizon. So, they're not sort of these cosmic vacuum cleaners. So that's probably the most persistent myth about black holes out there.
And they're not very close, are they? They're
right.
A long
the
way
likely, going. Yeah, because they result from the death of massive stars. Massive stars are rare. You know, there's about 100, small red dwarf stars, much smaller than the sun, than there are stars like the sun. And there may be even 10 times fewer stars that will become black holes than there are stars like the sun. So, there are essentially only one in 1,000 stars, round numbers, are going to turn into a black hole, which means the nearest examples are going to be pretty far away. If the nearest stars are 5 to 10 light years away, we're talking hundreds of light years for black holes, and that's pretty much what scientists have found.
You came up with the name Einstein's Monsters because of sort of the edge, or is it fair to say the event horizon of the black hole? Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, the monstrous aspect is in several senses of that word. The event horizon is a bizarre concept because it's not a physical barrier of any kind. It's sort of an information barrier. It's the place that demarcates regions we can see and access and interact with, and regions that are forever hidden from us because nothing can escape. And that's a sort of bizarre situation. Also, Einstein, not obvious to most people, although it was his theory of general relativity that best explains and accounts for black holes and their bizarre properties, he didn't believe in their existence. I mean, he thought they were essentially an artifact, a mathematical artifact of his theory. So it took him quite a while to believe that what his own theory had sort of predicted. And so to him, they were sort of monstrous, too. He thought they were an anomaly or an artifact. And so those are the senses of that word for me.
You mentioned before, can we can actually see a black hole, or did I misunderstand what you said?
Well, we can. There are black holes. The evidence that black holes exist is now very, very strong. It's grown steadily over decades. The black holes that we can see, a single isolated black hole in space would indeed be black and invisible because the event horizon is dark. But almost most stars, and black holes are not excluded from this, are in binary systems. They're companion, they have companion stars, and when a black hole is in a binary system, it will pull matter from the neighbor if it's close, and that, and so the material that falls onto a black hole or towards it is, of course, accelerated by the gravity, and while event horizon and inside it that remains hidden from us, the region near it is an extremely active region of hot gas swirling into an accretion disk, and it's that radiation and accelerated particles leading to radiation that led us to infer the existence of the black hole. So ironically, although the black hole itself is dark, the situations where we observe them are extremely bright and luminous and visible for far off in the galaxy.
So I've had guests on the show that have obviously hypothesized, but they have made comments or statements or talked about what it would be like to fall into a black hole. So I don't have the physics and the astronomy type of education to know if they're BSing or not. But is it possible to simulate or to come up with a hypothesis of what it would be like to fall into a black hole, or are we just being given a good spin by someone?
Well, no, it's actually, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, it has become possible to simulate that pretty well. I mean, basically, you can now, computers are powerful enough that you can put a black hole situation into a computer and simulate the full general relativity, you know, complicated equations being solved. And so you can actually, you know, make not a movie-like representation, but a full astrophysical simulation of a black hole. And so you can, yes, you can actually sort of say what it would be like, what it would seem like. The conventional wisdom that, you know, you'd be ripped apart or spaghettified if you fell into a black hole, that's pretty much true, because the gravity is so intense, it changes very rapidly, and so a person falling into a black hole or towards a black hole will be essentially pulled apart because the gravity between their feet and their head will be so extreme it'll literally rip them apart. So that part's true and of a thing that people say. You can also say how time would change for them and how what their perception of space as they fall into the black hole, what it would look like for them looking out. And again, those now computers are good enough that those are not really guesses or sort of, you know, speculations. I think they're real calculations.
What is the purpose of a black hole? What is their function? Why are they there in the first place?
They're sort of the end point of matter for massive objects in the universe. So, you know, normal stars like the sun are in a balanced state because they have fusion going on in their cores, making helium from hydrogen in the case of the sun. And that the radiation released from that fusion reaction is what keeps the star puffed up. Meanwhile, the gravity is trying to compress it and make it smaller. And while stars are fusing their nuclear material, they stay in balance, and they're the kind of objects we see in the sky. But then when that balance is broken, when the fuel is exhausted, they have to reconfigure, and they collapse usually to a denser state, to a higher temperature, and they ignite a new nuclear fuel and create a heavier element. And so the process of star evolution is a sequence of fusion reactions until there's no more energy to be released, and that happens with iron, which is the most stable element. So once you've made iron in the middle of a star, you're not getting any more energy out by fusion. And at that point, the core has to collapse, and in the theory that was worked out, you know, decades ago, there's nothing, if it's massive enough, there's nothing to resist that collapse anymore, and so you end up with the situation of a black hole. So they're sort of pretty much inevitable prediction of our understanding of how stars work, and especially how they die.
But it takes billions of years for this to happen. It's a slow process.
Well, actually, so in this case, not. These ones happen quickly. So the lifetime of a star depends on its mass, and more massive stars live shorter lives than less massive stars. So the sun's total lifetime as a fusion reactor is 10 billion years. There are low-mass stars, the more ubiquitous red dwarfs that live for hundreds of billions or even trillions of years. But going in the other direction, the more massive stars, like 10 times the mass of the sun, which would leave a black hole 3 times the mass of the sun, the lifetime of that star is like 20 million years. I mean, it's, in astronomy terms, quite short. So the stars that make black holes, the massive ones, actually run through their lifetimes quite quickly. But again, it's a very small fraction of all stars that will do this, because very few stars are massive enough to get to this point.
Is there any way to have any kind of an accurate count of the potential number of black holes in the universe?
Pretty much, because we know the populations of stars that that live and die and their mass distribution. Even if we can't detect all the black holes that result, it's a sort of population that we can understand. And so you can certainly generate a rough order of magnitude, and it's roughly 10 million black holes in the Milky Way in our galaxy, and a similar number in any galaxy like ours elsewhere. So in the universe, of course, that's 10 million times 100 billion galaxies. So it's a pretty large number of black holes out there.
I would say that. So when there's 10 million in the Milky Way, then in Andromeda there would be 10 million. And some point in a couple of billion years, as you point out in the book, they're going to come together and merge. So do the black holes merge? Do we now have 20 million, or do they become one big, humongous black hole? What happens at that point, as if any of us will be around?
So it's an interesting question. When we merge with Andromeda in about 4 billion years, the numbers are a little rough. Even when we merge with another galaxy, the spacing of stars is so large that they almost never collide or merge. So all the stars in those two galaxies, whether they're sun-like stars or black holes or neutron stars or anything, they actually have a very small probability of colliding or merging. So it'll happen very, very rarely. And so the regular stars will rarely collide or merge, and equally the black holes. And since there are very few black holes, their mergers will be even rarer. So, no, the individual black holes are not going to merge by that grand merger of the two galaxies. However, each galaxy, ours and Milky Way, has a central black hole, and those are big objects. Those are several million times the mass of the sun. And when our two galaxies merge, those two central black holes will indeed merge and, roughly double in mass.
So if people were alive, would we know the merger was happening? What would we sense living here in the United States, for example?
Yeah, I mean, anyone, if the Earth has life that far ahead, it would be, the whole sky would change. I mean, Andromeda is, of course, a naked eye object, but only just. You have to know exactly where you're looking and have a good dark sky. You don't need binoculars, though. It is naked eye. As this happens, of course, Andromeda will loom larger in the sky and be, incredibly obvious. And then as the two galaxies merge, the sky will get sort of chaotic. There'll be a lot of bright stars and the sort of streams of the two galaxies that get flung out by the merger, because it won't be a direct merger. It'll sort of be a glancing interaction, and then they will sweep by each other a few times, and then sort of the two nuclei will spiral together. So it actually takes about half a billion years for the whole thing to happen. And during that time, our sky will be really crazy with changing star patterns and more density of stars, so a lot more bright stars in the sky. It'll be quite spectacular. I mean, for someone who would be willing to watch this play out for a long period of time. The central black holes, of course, are going to be far away. Our center of our galaxy is 27,000 light years away, and there's a black hole there. And the Andromeda black hole probably won't come anywhere near where we are. So the big black hole merger will take place, at a safe distance, I would say. But it'll probably generate a lot of activity and radiation, too, so that will be visible.
So our environment living here would not necessarily change, but we'd notice the sky and things like that changing.
Yeah, our environment would not change, again, because the distance between stars is so huge. Even if there were Andromeda stars sweeping through our neighborhood of the Milky Way, they would just sweep through. They wouldn't collide, so we would see new bright stars in the sky coming and going over time. However, in the long term, the people who simulate that merger, that Andromeda-Milky Way merger, suggest that at our position in the Milky Way, as well as the computer's simulations can predict it, we have about a 50% chance, like a coin toss chance, of either being, by the gravitational interaction of these two big galaxies, of being sort of sent towards the center of the new merger, the new merged galaxy, or being tossed out of the galaxy entirely. And so, you know, either one would present a different outcome, and our, again, the future perspective of the Earth would change quite a lot, that we might be flung into a region that's really dense with stars, so the night sky is blazing with light. Maybe imagine the night sky is bright as the full moon all over because there's so many stars. Or we could be flung well out of the Milky Way, maybe looking down upon this this wonderful merger in process, you know, getting like a bird's eye view of it. So those are two possible scenarios for what the Earth would experience.
Jerry has our first email for the day. He's in Reno, Nevada, and he says, is there any evidence showing that the Milky Way has merged with galaxies up to now? Has that already happened in our history?
Yeah, there's good evidence of it, but not big ones, not like the Andromeda. It's possible that early in the Milky Way's history, I mean, by which I mean now 7, 8, 9 billion years ago, so really long time ago, it's possible the Milky Way merged with a big galaxy. After that length of time passing, we would just not have any good evidence of it, so it's impossible to tell. But what's more likely, and what we know is happening in other galaxies, and we do see in the Milky Way, is that big galaxies are sort of pretty much continuously devouring smaller galaxies, little satellite galaxies that are in the neighborhood or falling in from other parts of space. And so we see indications that the Milky Way has consumed other small galaxies and is doing so now. You know, some that are in the process of falling in or fell in, you know, a few hundred million years ago. We see these sort of streams of stars. Because when galaxies come together, they get sort of ripped apart by this tidal forces of gravity, so they don't keep their shapes. And that's a telltale of interaction and merger. And so we can see that now in the Milky Way. The Milky Way sort of shows, you know, fossilized evidence, if you like, of its merger history, but mostly with small things, not with a big thing.
John is in Phoenix, and he says, is Einstein the guy who discovered black holes, or what is the history of the discovery of black holes?
So the two sides of it are, of course, there's the theoretical side, so there's a prediction of black holes, which preceded the discovery. But unlike sort of pulsars, which are neutron stars, really, they were discovered accidentally, but they were predicted 30 years before. And it's a similar story with black holes. Black holes were a prediction from general relativity, and as I mentioned, Einstein resisted the implications of his own theory, but others working with the theory were quite aware that there was a prediction there. So Chandrasekhar, there were some famous astrophysicists in the 1920s and 1930s who recognized that general relativity was allowing the possibility of what we would call a black hole. So that theoretical awareness or prediction was sort of out there in the 30s, maybe, and certainly in the 40s. But, you know, nobody knew how to look for something that was black. They didn't realize at that point that they were likely to be in a binary system where they might get bright by pulling in material, so nobody really knew what to look for. And so the evidence for black holes took another 30 years to come in, and the archetype of black holes, and still pretty much the best evidence for any single black hole, is Cygnus X1, which is, in the terminology of X-ray astronomers, is the brightest X-ray source in the constellation Cygnus. So when X-ray satellites were first launched in the early to mid-1960s, nobody knew what these bright X-ray sources were, what could make X-rays. And it turns out that one of the things that can make X-rays is a binary star system where one star is a black hole and the other one is feeding matter onto it, and the matter gets extremely hot and accelerated and generates X-rays. So that became the first solid detection of a black hole. And I think the year in which it got nailed and people in the community said, yeah, that's a black hole, was like 1969.
So your book talks about early visionaries who played a role in this, and you specifically call out John Mitchell. So what was the role of these people? You even have Benjamin Franklin mentioned along with some others.
Yeah, Mitchell is an unsung hero of astronomy. In most people have never heard that name. He was a clergyman in England and an amateur astronomer, because there were no professional astronomers really at that time. We're talking about not long after Newton was alive, maybe 60, 70 years after Newton. And he was a recreational physicist and astronomer and observer, and he just took Newton's theory of gravity, and Newton's theory does not formally predict black holes, but he just extrapolated. He just extrapolated Newton's theory and said, well, what if you had a star that was so massive that the escape velocity was the speed of light? Then logically, that would be a dark star. So they were calling these things dark stars. And that was a pretty bold prediction to make that long ago. But again, there's nothing you could do with that, because nobody knew if these things were real or how you would possibly observe a dark star. But yeah, Mitchell was very far ahead of his time in that regard. And there were a couple of other, thinkers who worked their way around the idea of black holes. But it's not a full understanding or prediction, because Newton's theory doesn't really explain what's going on in a black hole. You can't get an event horizon out of Newton's theory. You can't talk about space-time being distorted in Newton's theory, because it's just not part of the theory. So these were sort of premonitions, if you like, of black holes from, very clever people just thinking boldly, but they weren't, a prediction in a formal sense.
Here's another one, more science fiction oriented. Ben is in Denver with this email and says, I do read a lot of science fiction, especially around time travel, and it seems that black holes are always mentioned or play some kind of role in time travel. Why is that?
It's not an illogical thing to invoke time travel with black holes, because they do cause such extreme distortions of space and time. So the only way you can get time travel out of a black hole is if somehow the black hole, which is a region of space-time that's sort of pinched off, it's sequestered or concealed from the rest of the universe, if that somehow connects to another region of space-time. And therefore, you're sort of, the black hole itself is connecting two disparate regions of space-time. And then maybe the other side of that is a white hole, sort of counterpart of a black hole. So that idea of a black hole as a portal to another part of the universe is speculative, but it's not against general relativity. It doesn't violate any law of physics or our theory of gravity. It's just that we have no evidence that it actually happens in the real universe. And if you have that kind of a portal or connection between two distinct space-time regions because of the black hole, then, in principle, you can sort of short-circuit the issues of time, and you can generate a time travel scenario. So that's where that idea comes from. So it's not ridiculous. It's not crazy speculation. It's not pure science fiction. But there's no evidence that white holes exist. There's no evidence that black holes are portals to other parts of the universe. And so there's no evidence that we can time travel with that mechanism.
Or I guess any other mechanism, right?
Or any other mechanism. But if you're looking in real physics or astrophysics for possibility of time travel, that's pretty much the best way to do it, or best place to look.
Is through a black hole?
Yeah, through a wormhole, as they would call it. That a wormhole just is the sort of term for a black hole that's connecting to another part of the universe, rather than just being a sink and that's the end of it.
So if the forces of gravity and stuff in the black hole would tear you apart, why wouldn't a wormhole tear you apart?
Probably would. So the caveat there, which is interesting, is, as I mentioned, nature makes black holes that are very different in mass, like our galaxy has a big one at the center, 4 million times the mass of the sun. So if you sort of follow what happens with the stretching of the gravity stretching force around a black hole, for a black hole that results from the death of a massive star, it indeed would rip human material apart or a body apart. But as the black holes get bigger, the stretching force, the tidal force, is gentler. I mean, the gravity is strong, but the difference between the gravity on your head and your feet, for example, is not as large. And so above like 1,000 times the mass of the sun, and there are black holes that massive and lots more that are more massive, you actually could survive the passage into a black hole without being ripped apart. I mean, nobody knows what would happen or what you'd see past the event horizon. That's mysterious. No way for science to predict. So, interestingly, you know, the massive black holes in the universe are black holes that, you know, could be infected. You could survive passage into them. The trouble is they're far away. You know, we're talking, so the nearest black hole of any kind, the star death black hole, is just, like I said, a few hundred light years. The nearest big black hole, big enough to survive falling into, is, you know, probably going to be thousands or tens of thousands of light years away. So they're not even... and they're not even in the neighborhood.
Interesting questions today, at least from my layman sort of perspective. So, Paul is in Miami. I'm assuming that's Miami, Florida. He's not saying. And he says, I am very familiar with concepts and some guests on space shuttle programs that have talked about being able to do intergalactic travel through folding space. Some of the destinations that one might try to go to by folding space are really far away. What if a black hole was in the way of folding space for intergalactic travel, or am I asking a crazy question?
It's not a crazy question, but I think he's conflating two things. So I was just talking about the folding space idea. I didn't use that term, but that's the sort of idea of a wormhole, sort of the black hole as a portal to another part of the universe. So let's call that the folding space concept.
Okay.
So like I said, we've got no evidence that actually happens in the real universe. But if it did, yes, that's a way to travel extremely large distances, you know, instantly or trivially or quickly. So if that mechanism exists, then yes, you have, you know, you have this what amounts to time travel or instantaneous travel over large distances faster than light can do it, of course. So it's like a lot of things with black holes. People sort of, they glom on to the most exciting, exotic aspect of the theory, in this case wormholes. We're talking about wormholes. But scientists always put a pause button on and say, wait. Okay, they're allowed by the theory, but something being allowed by the theory is very far from saying it actually happened or we could observe it or we have observed it, and none of those are true for wormholes. So, you know, astronomers are, you know, sensibly skeptical about the existence of wormholes because there's no evidence that they exist in our universe.
So is the no evidence that they exist a limitation of our technology, or is it more likely a law of physics?
It's not clear, actually. I mean, so, you know, we really don't know a lot about black holes because they are far away. They're difficult to inspect. We've never seen, we're probably close to some experiments that might show that event horizons really exist the way physics would understand them. But that's after decades of work. So it's been very slow to really scrutinize black holes in enough detail to understand their properties. So it's been slow work experimentally or observationally. So I think it's just a limitation of the field. It's just, you know, it's just early days of understanding black holes by observation. And so, you know, really it's hard to rule things out when your observations are still in their very, very early stages.
So it's not necessarily an issue of needing more sophisticated technology.
Well, some of it is because black hole, the event horizon of a black hole is tiny, tiny region of space. So the sun, you know, is 1.5 million kilometers across in diameter. And if the sun were squashed into a black hole, the sun will not turn into a black hole. It's not massive enough for that to happen naturally. But if you wanted to make it a black hole, you'd shrink it to about 3 kilometers across. So you're talking about the difference between looking at something in space that, you know, 1.5 million kilometers across and 3 kilometers across. So really tiny objects. And that's the sun. That's the nearest star. Now you're talking about something that's, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of times further away than the sun is. So you can see that the event horizon itself is so impossibly tiny at that distance that we just don't have a technology that can resolve it or inspect it. So it's a limitation of the technology, but that's almost being unkind to the technology. It's just an incredibly hard experiment.
Kathy is in Seattle, and Kathy says, I'm under the impression that an actual definition and explanation for gravity is still elusive, although there are good competing theories. You're talking about gravity quite a bit, especially with the black hole and the event horizon. What causes gravity? Am I wrong? Do we actually have a definitive 100% de facto reason to explain gravity? Or do we just still have close and good theories, but not quite there yet?
Well, it's a good question. And I would say the basic answer is we have a very good and excellent theory of gravity. General relativity, which is just over 100 years old now as a theory, has passed every test put to it with flying colors. So by any hallmark, it's a very successful theory. It's not failed any test. It makes definitely different predictions from Newton's theory. So it's a superior theory in the sense of explaining more different situations. However, it's not been tested in some regimes. Like, it's been hard to test general relativity in the most extreme gravity situations, such as black holes. So it's not like general relativity has an asterisk by it for any reason that it's failed a test, but it just hasn't been tested in the regimes you'd like to test it, which are strong gravity, black hole type situations. But we're maybe going to get some of those tests. And gravitational waves were the first of those tests. And again, general relativity passed that test beautifully and explained the results from LIGO and the gravity waves detected 2 years ago exquisitely well. So again, general relativity is passing all the tests put to it. So in that sense, really good theory. No ding against it at all. However, it's not the final theory of gravity from a physics perspective because it cannot reconcile. There are these two currently irreconciled fundamental theories of physics, one being general relativity, the theory of mass and matter and gravity and curved space-time, and the other being the theory of fundamental particles, a standard model of particle physics, as it's called. And those two theories are not combined. No one's managed to combine them successfully into one super theory of everything. And so in that sense, it's not the final theory of gravity because it's not able to explain all the things that happen in the subatomic world.
She sent in a follow-up, which I'll read now, and she says, when I hear gravity theory is a push-pull theory or Lesage gravity theory, should I ignore these? They've been outdated.
There are no, I don't want to state it too strongly, but there are no strong rivals to general relativity, and that the one she mentions is one of those potential rivals. But there are some alternative theories that have actually been refuted in the last 20 years. So, you know, there are rivals to general relativity because, as I mentioned, it doesn't talk about the world of subatomic particles, and there are some people trying to reconcile those two in a different framework for gravity. But there's nothing on the table right now that supersedes general relativity, is better than it, refutes it. That doesn't mean people aren't still looking or thinking about it. There's active theoretical work on gravity and experiment on, you know, theoretical exploration of other ideas, because that's what theorists like to do. But it's a pretty, you know, if you have a test that's been passing all its challenges with flying colors for a century, it's a pretty mature and well-established theory.
I have another email question from you, and this is Paul in New York, and he says, I'm curious as if the black hole science that you've been talking about or that hasn't been talked about yet plays a role or has any impact in our outward search for exoplanets light years away from Earth, trying to find possible life other than on Earth. Do black holes play any part in the universe for life or exoplanets or anything like that?
They don't have a formal connection to exoplanets. A black hole as a dead star could possibly have exoplanets around it, but of course those exoplanets would not be getting any radiation from a star, so they're probably the last places you would look for life. So exoplanets might exist around black holes in the sense that planets exist around stars of all kinds, but that's, like I said, the last place to think of life existing. So no, there's no formal connection between exoplanets and black holes, nor is there with biology, because again, a black hole is a situation where all the radiation and the light, the life-giving energy of the sun, is gone and is not there. So there's sort of the anti-life places, if you like. They're the least propitious places to look for life is near a black hole or around a black hole.
Their impact on the solar system or the universe doesn't have anything to do with searching for life or exoplanets or anything like that?
There's no formal connection, no. I would say a simple answer.
Can a telescope like Hubble, it can't see anything like that. It still is beyond the technical capability of Hubble, and probably would James Webb be able to detect it?
Detect what? Black hole?
Yeah, the black hole or the tiny event horizon as you've described it.
Yeah, so the event horizons of normal black holes, the small kind that massive stars leave behind, they're so small, like the 3 kilometers seen trillions of miles away. That's beyond any technology on the horizon. However, the big black holes, their event horizons are correspondingly bigger. In fact, in the math of it is that the size of the event horizon goes with the mass of the black hole. So the black hole, the Milky Way center, which is 4 billion times the mass of the sun, is 4 million times the mass of the sun, is about a million times bigger than the event horizon of a normal black hole, a small one. So those are now big event horizons, and there are experiments with radio telescopes trying to resolve the event horizon of the black hole in our galaxy center, and they're close to succeeding. So that's very exciting, because you can't see the event horizons of regular small black holes, but the big one, especially the big one in our center, our galaxy center, is amenable to observation with radio telescopes. And that experiment is being in my university in Arizona as part of a network of radio telescopes trying to take these images in the radio waves. And it's very close to succeeding. It's within a year or so of taking a picture, a radio picture, if you like, of the event horizon.
What would that radio wave picture look like?
Well, it would probably show that some of the distortions of space and time right at or around the event horizon, and it would present a new way to test general relativity, because the way light behaves near the event horizon is only predictable in general relativity, and so people are running models and simulations ahead of time to say, oh, this is what the radio waves or what that radio image would look like. And they're going to match those predictions against the observations pretty soon. And that'll be a brand new test of general relativity and the first insight into what an event horizon, the vicinity of an event horizon, the immediate vicinity actually looks like. So that's exciting, and that's close to happening. But other black holes are much further away in other galaxies, of course, because then they're millions of light years away instead of 27,000 light years away. So they get harder to observe. So pushing the observations in this subject is hard because the objects of your study are so small and so far away.
Doesn't seem very fair.
Well, the interesting, yeah, I know. Nobody said the universe had to be easy, and it's amazing some ways that we know as much as we do, but, you can't expect everything to sort of just sit on a plate and be available to you. It doesn't always work that way.
So there is no fairness doctrine in nature, I guess.
No, apparently. nobody took us into account in setting all this up.
Do you ever feel like we're not supposed to push this far and get answers or get this information? Do you feel like there are natural impediments that people have to sort of circumvent and try to go around and figure out, and maybe we're in areas that we're not supposed to be looking at or researching?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think a couple of things. It's possible we're just not smart enough to figure some things out. So if for example, there's a super theory, a wonderful theory of gravity goes beyond general relativity and explains everything, particle physics and everything else. We may not be smart enough to do that. Some very prominent physicists have even speculated that the next theory of gravity or the final theory of gravity or the theory of everything, whatever people like to call it, may be sort of beyond our intellectual capability. So that's one possibility. The other one is the practical one that I mentioned, that sometimes the objects of your study are so difficult to observe in a practical sense that you don't have it. You're available to you a technology that will let you observe them. It's just sometimes how it works. And that may be true of any civilization. It might not be our limitation or our problem. It just may be a problem in nature. Some things are just extremely difficult to access observationally. And we don't know that for sure. I mean, astronomers are pretty clever and thought of clever, not workarounds for everything, but sort of experiments that let us gain knowledge and capability. And, you know, astronomy's been doing that since the invention of the telescope for 400 years. So I think astronomers are optimistic enough to think we'll invent new techniques or improve current techniques. And, you know, astronomers are not quitters. They don't sort of take the perspective, oh, that's too hard. We're just not going to try doing it anymore.
We do need to take our break, but I'm going to do this one email before the break because I think you'll probably do it real quickly. And I think it's the guy's serious, although, you know, maybe it's silly to me. But Jim is in Los Angeles, and he says, if Mr. Musk and others like him are correct and we're living in a simulation, then is all of this nonsense and we're wasting time? Is there any way to know if Musk is right and we're living in a simulation? And then again, I would say, why bother? Because the rules of the computer program are probably something that we're not meant to understand or even realize that we are in a computer program.
Right. I'm not sure Elon Musk, I've not heard Elon Musk say we're living in a simulation. Maybe he has.
All the time. He says it all the time that we're living in a simulation.
I mean, he's not, to be fair to the people who invented that idea, he's not the originator of that concept. Probably the name that should be attached to that is Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher in Oxford. Anyway, Musk, yes, he may have said it too. And I guess I think it's fine. That's just a clever, construct, a conceit, if you like, to say that everything is consistent with us living in a simulation. It's a solipsist philosophical position. Nothing is real. I mean, it's an ancient philosophical position as well. So I don't tend to hold that because I have no evidence to believe that. You know, you're trying to be skeptical as a scientist, which you always should be, and have minimum economic hypotheses, then that seems to be a bizarre, outlandish hypothesis for nature or our situation. So I choose not to entertain that seriously. I recognize it as an interesting argument, and I've played with it myself. But it's off to the side just as a sort of, you know, little novelty item, if you like, in the conceptual world of astronomy.
Is there any theory out there that really supports it as being real, or is it just a novel idea that people toss around and from time to time play with?
No, there's no, I mean, again, you hold theories to the standards of scientific method. They have to be testable. They have to be, you know, disprovable and possibly you have to be possible to disprove them. And of course, if the construct is that the simulation is so well done, which you imagine it would be, that you can't tell you're in a simulation, then almost by definition, it's not testable. So, you know, the concept itself is sort of takes it out of the realm of science, at which point the scientist, you know, can't be blamed for not taking it seriously.
Clearly the simulation's not running on Windows. I'll give them credit for that. We're going to take our break, and listeners, we'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Impey. The phone is available if you would like to use it rather than email 1-866-687-7223, and we do answer the phone during the break. And email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Monday program. Our guest today, Dr. Chris Impey from the University of Arizona. We're talking about his new book, which, by the way, Chris, comes out in November. Is that correct?
That's right. I think it's the 13th of November.
Okay, just in time for the holiday season. Einstein's Monsters, The Life and Times of Black Holes. And before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsors. I skipped over them and, at the first part of the show, but I do want to thank Northrop Grumman, AIAA. They have their big meeting in Orlando going on right now. I'm sorry I'm not there, but their space meetings are always fun to go to. Celestis is a sponsor, Space Development Network, the National Space Society, the Integrated Space Plan. We featured them on the Space Show yesterday, and of course the Space Foundation. So they all play an instrumental role in bringing everyone the Space Show, and we thank our sponsors very, very much. So, Chris, during the break, you mentioned talking or highlighting or saying more about big black holes, otherwise technically supermassive black holes. What is the guideline for what makes a black hole a big black hole?
So I think the simplest distinction is between the black holes that result from the death of massive stars, which, again, are a small fraction of all stars. But those were the first black holes to be detected, Cygnus X-1, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And those are black holes that are they're more massive than the sun, because the sun will not become a black hole. It will die as a white dwarf. So their lowest mass is about three times the mass of the sun. And those massive star black holes can go up to maybe 30, 50 times the mass of the sun. That's their range. And that's pretty big. That's beefy for a star. Obviously, the biggest stars that can exist end up as black holes. But discovered in a kind of chaotic way, because there was no single observation that led to their discovery, we've now realized that every galaxy in the universe, as far as we can tell, has a massive black hole or supermassive black hole in it. And that's an exciting discovery, because they're completely different entities. They are, again, the Milky Way one is probably the low end of the range. That's 4 million times the mass of the sun. And the high end of the range is about 20 billion times the mass of the sun. So it's a big range in itself. And every galaxy has one. And as far as we can tell, the mass of the central black hole in the galaxy scales or correlates with the mass of the old stars in the galaxy. So there's something determining in how they form that scales them with how many stars the galaxy has.
So there's only one per galaxy, or could a galaxy have more than one?
It could. I mean, there's usually one, and it's bang at the center. It sort of defines the gravitational center of the galaxy. There is an interesting question. Could there be more than one? Typically, no. Each galaxy has one. But, as we mentioned earlier, galaxies merge occasionally and combine, like we will combine with Andromeda in 4 billion years, and big galaxies do merge elsewhere in the universe, you know, routinely. And, of course, when they merge, their black holes merge. So we can see examples of that process happening out there in the universe. So there are what are called binary mass supermassive black holes, which represent, you know, a phase of a merger of two galaxies where the big black holes are in the process of combining. So, yes, we can see that happening, too.
Maybe because I'm not a scientist, I just have a big interest in it, but it seems that everything is really ordered, but that how did all of this get ordered? I mean, how does the rule book come into existence for all of this? How could something this complex with so many different, you know, rules and laws and variations and on, how could it even come into existence or evolve? That's probably the fundamental question that everyone asks, but it seems to defy any kind of explanation as to how something this organized, and I think it from my perspective, it seems organized. How it ever got implemented in the first place?
So it does seem amazing. I mean, it seems like, you know, if you're going out on a limb, you say, oh, this is like intelligent design. You know, how could it all be so complicated and structured and ordered and, you know, beautiful spiral galaxies and black holes at the centers of them and so on. And even to a physicist or an astronomer, that's amazing too. But I think the counter to that is that, especially now with the power of computers, if you just put into a computer a smooth early universe situation, which is just gas, you know, hot plasma really, because it's hot, and the universe is small and dense, and there's essentially no structure, you know, and so really it's not complicated, and there's no great design, and there's no pattern, and you just let it evolve in a computer, in a simulation, we can do those really well now, you end up with a universe like the one we live in. You show that galaxies will form by gravity, you show that within the galaxy stars will form, you can show that some galaxies will look spiral, and some will look elliptical, like we see, and you can show that they form central black holes in their center. So the simulations, which operate off the laws of physics, you know, they're not just sort of made up things, are able to show that from just simple conditions and just the law, just the force of gravity and some molecular and atomic forces, of course, you can generate all the things we see. So it stops being magical or mystical or, you know, some divine pattern at that point. It's just emergent properties from natural laws and simple physics.
Well, how did the natural laws get there?
Well, that's a different question. That's still a very good question. And, you know, Stephen Hawking, who was lost to us last year or this year, you know, he also worried about that. He thought about the big questions. And, you know, that's, again, probably reaching to a limitation of our understanding, perhaps our ability to understand. The Big Bang is a very good theory of how the universe evolved from a hot, dense, early state. And that's it. You know, the people who say, well, what came before the Big Bang, or what was the precursor state, or what caused the Big Bang, or why was there a Big Bang? Those are questions science actually can't answer right now. And it's, I think, you know, it's important to note that astronomers who are trying to answer big questions are quite happy to say, oh, I can't answer that. No, sorry, we don't know the answer to that. We don't have a good theory, or we just don't know, or we can't access it with observation. So the issue of where did the laws of physics come from is in that category. It's in the same category as the question of what caused the Big Bang, and it's a question we can't answer. And that doesn't mean people don't like to speculate or, you know, throw ideas around. And as long as they just remember they're just throwing ideas around and they're not necessarily doing science, then that's fine, too. But that's really a question we can't answer right now.
Henry sent in an email from Dallas, and he says, black holes do have radiation, and those effects can, I guess, be measured. does black hole radiation, especially if it's a big black hole, have anything to do with impacting human spaceflight?
Not really, because, again, black holes are so far away. So the nearest black hole, a few hundred light years away, which is hundreds of thousands of trillions of miles, so incredibly far away. And we're not even able to send people to Mars yet. So that's just a different realm. So I maybe in some far distant future when we can get nearer light speed travel, even then, of course, if you think about it, if you have near light speed travel, you're still talking about centuries to get to the nearest black hole. So putting those two things on the same page, human spaceflight and black holes, is really implausible because it's so far beyond our capability, or even maybe our capability ever, because of the extreme distances and the difficulty of traveling that far in our own galaxy.
I remember the Enterprise went up to black holes.
Yeah, and so science fiction just finesses the whole thing by having faster than light travel. I mean, warp speed is essentially breaking the laws of physics by saying, okay, let's just, physics is a pain because it says you can't do all these things. So let's just take physics out of it and say we can go faster than light. And then you have this wonderful world of Star Wars and Star Trek and warp speed and so on. And that's where science fiction is truly fiction, truly fiction. There's no indication that we can do that, and in fact it violates the laws of physics to say that we could. So, you know, that's where physicists and astronomers are kind of killjoys, because they just say, okay, it's cool stuff, and I love science fiction too, and I love the movies, and I love the ideas, but it's not real, it's not science.
But, I mean, this is probably not related to black holes, but there are physicists working on some pretty far out advanced propulsion ideas, like Dr. Woodward with Mach thrusters and the M-drive, mm-hmm. and things like that. Are they batting their heads against the wall, or is there a possibility that they may figure something out?
I think there are some that have been in the news, and I'm aware of. I think the ones that are trying to get relativistic travel, which is, well, you know, obviously our best space flight with, and we're using chemical rockets, for goodness sake. I mean, there's just 100. The rockets we're using, even Elon Musk's super sophisticated rockets, are really just cousins of Saturn V and rockets that were developed 60 or so years ago. So we really haven't moved on. But some of these propulsion ideas are at least relativistic. They're attempts to get us to a fraction of the speed of light, 5 or 10% of the speed of light. That would be fantastic, because that would be hundreds or thousands of times faster than we can go through space now. So that's an incredible advantage and gain. But it's still just, it's not pushing laws of physics at all. It's just making an incredible progress by using new technology. So I would distinguish those ideas, propulsion systems, which would be very exciting, and sure, absolutely we should do that, because that'll let us leave the solar system and do all sorts of things, from the ones that claim or speculate about faster than light travel. And that just simply, you know, violates physics, and you just don't get to throw away the rule book. So people who think they are seeing a way to throw away the rule book, I think, deserve a lot of skepticism, because history has shown that the speed of light is an absolute limit. You know, going back to relativity, so that's another 100 years of testing this idea. The people who say they can do that or think it's possible have essentially all been wrong. So that's not a good batting average when the next idea comes around that says it can do that.
Well, what about the folks, and again, I will give airtime to most anyone and most any idea within reason, although if I just devoted this show to the fringe, there would be no time to do anything else, because the fringe is growing faster than any other segment, as far as I can tell, or the wacky,
yeah.
Or the wacky crazy fringe. Yeah, I mean, it is fun, but what about the people that are claiming what we need is our new physics, and we just haven't discovered the new physics yet to allow all of this to happen?
I mean, that's fair enough to say that. I don't object to that idea. And I would also agree with it in the sense that our physics is not complete. So we can have very successful physics, like general relativity, very successful theory of gravity. We've been talking about it now for a while. and then also admit that it's not the final ultimate theory of nature because it doesn't allow you to reconcile gravity and fundamental particles and their behaviors, quantum physics, basically. So absolutely, we need some new physics because our physics is not complete. We don't know what dark matter is in cosmology. We don't know what dark energy is in cosmology. We have a Higgs particle that supposedly is a mechanism for mass, but it doesn't really explain why particles have the mass they do and so on. So there's all these little missing pieces of, and they're not little, missing pieces of physics. So absolutely, some new physics would be great. But that new physics will be treated with, will be put to the test of experimental observation and skepticism, you know, because most wild theories are just wild theories and wrong. So, I think that's fine. You know, general relativity was put to a lot of skeptical testing before people got comfortable with it and thought, yeah, it's probably right. You know, I mean, it seems to work in every situation we've tested it. So you can both admit that your physics is incomplete and be suitably skeptical about people who claim to have new physics, especially new physics that violates your existing physics, like faster than light travel, because history has shown so far that those ideas tend to be wrong. I mean, if they really are on their head, turn on their head what conventional wisdom is, then it's almost certain that they're wrong.
What is the, is there an average life expectancy for a black hole and until it just fades away?
Yes, it's an incredible time scale. So this is the legacy of Stephen Hawking. It's the idea that black holes radiate or evaporate. And the genesis of that idea was his awareness, Hawking's awareness, as he explored the nature of black holes. Well, everything in the universe has a temperature and is subject to the laws of thermodynamics. You know, those are, again, that's some of our wonderful physics that's actually 250 years old and very successful. So he said, well, black holes should not be exempt from thermodynamics, and logically they should have a temperature too. And that temperature, in calculating it, turns out to be incredibly small temperature, teeny, teeny fraction of a degree Kelvin. But he also figured out the mechanism by which they could radiate, Hawking radiation, named after him. And the consequence of that speculation is that black holes, because they're losing energy and or mass, they're the same thing, equals mc squared, then they're evaporating. And he calculated the time scale. And so for a black hole, a massive star that dies, like the ones we started talking about, the three times the mass of the sun type black hole, the time for it to evaporate, say starting now, is 10 to the power 68 years. So one with 68 zeros after it. Just almost a crazy, insane time scale, so incredibly long, almost eternal. But that came from his theory. You know, it's a prediction, essentially, that it could be very, very hard to test. And as is Hawking radiation itself. So the thing that Hawking became most famous for, this idea that black holes evaporate or radiate, you know, you would want to test that idea. And it's just, we don't have a way to test it right now because the radiation is so feeble and so cold. And we don't have a black hole anywhere near us to look at carefully, that nobody's figured out a way to test Hawking's main idea, the one he became famous for.
Interesting. Is there research going on to try to figure out how to test it, or is it just sitting there?
It's sitting there because it's so beyond what we can do right now. So, you know, the microwave background, the coldest temperature thing that we can measure in the universe is the radiation left over from the Big Bang. That's like 2.7 Kelvin, so 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. A black hole's Hawking radiation has a temperature of like a nano Kelvin, like 10 to the minus 9 Kelvin. And there is no technology, even that astronomers have conceived of, that could measure a temperature that tiny. It's just so subtle. And then there's the distance thing we've already talked about, and the fact that the nearest example is so far away you wouldn't be able to see the region that's emitting that radiation, the event horizon, this tiny little region. So, you know, truthfully, observational astronomers are not staying up at night worrying about how to measure Hawking radiation. They just think it's essentially undetectable now and maybe forever.
So is this one of those things where there's huge cash prizes if you develop a way to do that, like math problems?
Well, it could be, but I don't know that many experimental physicists, the kind of physicists who could possibly win such a prize, are willing to, even for a large cash prize, they're probably not willing to sink their career into something that difficult. They'll probably take a better bet. They'll take a smaller bet for a more plausible experiment.
Is that something that 100 years from now it might be testable, or 200 years, or never?
Yeah, 100 years, sure. I mean, I'm always aware of how fast technology moves, so I'm never willing to say never in technology, because our technology has advanced so far in the last 100 years. So yeah, 100 years, 200 years, sure. I'll say we might be able to do it. I just know that anything we have in development or on the edge of development now, so 10, 15, 20 years, no way. So possibly, you know, if you want to play it out long enough and you're optimistic, we might get there. Just like we might get to relativistic travel in space, 10% of the speed of light. That's not also in the next 10, 15, 20 years. I'll bet a lot of money on that. But 100 years from now, 200, maybe.
So are you looking globally, like at work going on in other countries, like in China, Russia, other places have physics and science, scientists too? They're all stymied by the same limitations?
Yeah, it's a very international field now. I mean, we live in this sort of kind of vulcanized political world where our countries are our friends or our enemies, or, you know, and we sort of, one of the nice things about science, one of the things I like about it as a career, is it's very international. I mean, you know, the meetings you go to will have Russians and Chinese people and Arabs and Europeans and South Americans, and everyone just gets on. I mean, English is the common language, and as it is in science anywhere. So, you know, the borders that divide us as a planet really don't exist much in science. People work on the interesting problems, and they collaborate if they can. And occasionally their governments make that hard and stop getting in the way. They won't give people visas, or won't let you travel or study in another country. And that's just viewed as an intense annoyance by scientists, because they just want to solve problems and work on things. They don't care about, you know, the origin, the country of origin of the person they're collaborating with or working with.
So I typically hear from students when I do programs with physics and astronomy. This show is no exception. So I have a note from Joe in Boulder. So I'm assuming he's at UC, University of Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm a freshman in physics, and I'd like to know if there is a specific academic path to study and wrestle with the kind of issues and challenges you've been talking about today. Is it physics, astronomy, math? What would you recommend? And are all schools equal in that whatever you get from the school is only a basic thing, even if you get an advanced degree, and most of what you're going to do in these fields is on-the-job training?
Right. So there's a series of very good questions. As far as the career path of being able to study these frontier research questions, you know, he's on the right track, because physics is the foundation of astrophysics and astronomy. So, my first degree, my bachelor's degree, was physics, and I would say 70 or 80% of my colleagues, 70 or 80% of, say, professors of astronomy around the country had their first degrees in physics or their first training in physics. So it's absolutely the foundation and a very good first degree. And hopefully, if you have a nice program, your physics degree will include upper division courses in astrophysics that give you the flavor of the subject, and maybe even, you know, start to talk about black holes and so on, and as you're in the junior or senior. And then, you know, typically then you will do a PhD in astrophysics for astronomy. And even then, you're still doing physics when you do graduate courses in an astronomy PhD program. Your graduate courses are actual physics courses, like plasma physics or general relativity, and some of them are, and others are astrophysics, so they're physics too. So physics is always a part of the deal, and that's what lets you work on these kind of problems. And then as far as the And then as far as where to do this, I mean, Colorado's a great place. So he's already in a great place because the Colorado physics and their astronomy department and astrophysics program is very strong, big faculty, good research, lots of stuff going on. So he's already in a good, really good place, both for undergrad and grad. And there are probably a dozen or 15 good schools around the country for either for the bachelor level where you get really good training and you get some good astronomy and astrophysics even as a physics major, and the same number of schools that will do really high-level PhD in astronomy, which will give you a good track into a job or a career. The last part of the question about training, on-the-job training and so on, yes, at some level, you know, once you become a researcher, your training starts to be on the job, because once you've got your credentials, your bachelor and your PhD, you do need a PhD to do research in astronomy. Sometimes you can do it with just a master's, but generally a PhD. Then you're going to be working on a project, and you are going to be learning on the job. You know, you might get hired as a postdoc to work on some Hubble Space Telescope data. That's a very particular project that the PI or your boss proposed, and so you're going to have to learn about this chunk field of science and this data set and the problems that are being addressed by that data on the job, and you'll draw on your training, your physics and your courses and maybe research experience you had. So, but yeah, there's a lot of on-the-job training, and your what you do in research will depend on the, you know, the nature of your job, your postdoc, or your employment.
You know, I interview lots of people from the sciences on the space show, and probably 90% of them, 95% of them in their bios tell what schools they went to and what degrees they have. So a huge portion have gone to schools that I've not heard of, or are certainly not in the top 12 or 15 that you're thinking of. And then they go on to get an advanced degree, usually in a more recognizable school, but not always. But then they're in incredible positions at NASA or JPL or at Arizona or another university teaching, or they've written some incredible paper that somebody has sent me, and that's why they're on the show. So it doesn't seem to me that school always is a determining factor. I mean, coming from the business world, my hunch is that an individual's makeup and value system seems to be much more of a determining factor on what happens to their career than their school. Do you have any comments on that, or is school really that important?
I think it's a fair statement, and in science in general and in astronomy in particular, you know, the landscape is broadened in terms of the best programs and the best schools. It's more competitive, so You know, maybe 50 years ago, if you didn't go to Berkeley or Harvard or Caltech, or, you know, either as an undergrad or a grad student, you know, those were the elite schools, and everyone knew what they are, and the list was quite small of the elite schools. And then when you went off that list, you dropped down significantly. Well, those elite schools are still the elite schools. Harvard and Stanford and Caltech and Berkeley and Chicago and so on are still the elite schools, mostly private universities, so quite wealthy as well. But the cohort of good schools, very strong schools, truly competitive, absolutely good places from which to get a job, has expanded a lot, because there's a lot of good public universities. There's up-and-coming universities. There's universities that have invested in science because they think it's important. So, yeah, it's a more dynamic marketplace for training, and there are a lot of good choices now. That's great for students. It means you don't have to say, well, if I can't get into Harvard or Caltech or Stanford, I have no hope. That's not the case at all. So you're right. Your perception is right. It is broader in terms of the good schools and the good programs. But, you know, some employers look at the nuances and, you know, and still will draw distinctions between those elite schools and the next tier, however they want to think about it. But you're also right in what you said about how the individual, the merits of the individual, their level of initiative and experience and their ability to solve problems and their communication skills, those attributes of the individual become equally important to the school you went to, you know, and employers will want to see that too. When you're in an interview or you have to submit written work or you show what you can do, they'll be looking at that because that's what matters to them too. Which is good news. It's good news. It doesn't mean, it means it's a more meritocratic, democratic process than probably it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
You have a note from Barbara in Denver, and she says, I'm assuming an actual birth of a black hole can be detected. This is probably through radiation, right? Is there any way to know what has happened to that black hole since you're looking so far back in time when you see the birth of it? Would it still be in existence millions of years later because you're looking millions of years back given how far away it is?
Yeah, so well, again, we have to distinguish the small and the big black holes. So the small ones, the ones like the death of a massive star, yeah, they announce their birth very dramatically because the precursor to every black hole like that is a supernova. And supernova is the dying star that brightens by a factor of a billion and can be seen enormously far away. So a supernova is the calling card, the birth announcement of a black hole in many cases. Not in all cases. Sometimes it leaves behind a neutron star, so we don't always know with a given supernova what it's leaving behind. But that's a pretty dramatic birth announcement. The massive black holes in the centers of galaxies kind of grow more, they don't grow out of one dramatic event, or they don't form out of one dramatic event. They grow by gradual mergers and accretions over billions of years, so they don't have any dramatic birth announcement. They just grow steadily from small seed to the big things they are now. And yes, they will live a long time. As we mentioned, the evaporation time of a star, like a sun-like star, more massive than the sun, is this 10 to the 68 years. So that's how long the black hole will persist, having formed, whenever it formed.
So we're seeing the form of it when we see the supernova. So wherever it's located, how far back it is, can astronomers extrapolate to know what that black hole is doing today?
Well, the nearby, they're not huge distances. As I mentioned, the nearest black holes are a few hundred light years away. So if we saw a supernova go off, 500 light years away, say,
okay.
Then we could say, oh yeah, a black hole formed. Of course, it formed 500 years ago. So, you're looking back in time as you look out in space. So, in that sense, we're looking, we have a time gap between the radiation we see and when the event actually occurred. That's always going to be true.
So would we have an idea of what it was doing today if we could see it real time?
No. I mean, that's just a limitation of physics, light travel time. So if the black hole is 500 light years away, you're stuck seeing 500-year-old information of what it's doing. And asking the question, what is it doing now, is not answerable in physics because nothing travels faster than light.
So a computer couldn't simulate what it's doing now?
Yeah, a computer could do it, sure. So a computer can simulate its future evolution and probably quite reliably. You just can't test it. Observationally, you're stuck with old light.
So it's an untestable extrapolation.
It's testable if you have patience. You just have to wait 500 years and then you'll see.
No, I mean for the person pushing the buttons on the keyboard of the computer, it's not gonna, whatever you get back is not testable.
Right. No, it's just, ancient light is, distant light is old light. That's just the reality of the universe we live in. So, everything is within that context.
Distant light is old light. We're coming close to the end of the program. What else should we have talked to you or asked you about regarding your book and black holes that has escaped me? I didn't even know to ask you about it.
Oh, we've covered a lot of good ground. I mean, I think the thing I had the most fun with, not the most fun, but the thing I had fun with in writing the book was trying to inject a lot of stories, human stories, because the people who did this work, the theorists and the observers, in lots of areas of astronomy, there are some interesting stories there. And my own research personally has been on supermassive black holes for a few decades, so I was able to put not inject myself in the book particularly, but to tell some stories of my acquaintance, talk about people I knew and people I worked with and what it was like to observe a supermassive black hole in a 10-billion-year-old galaxy with a large telescope in Chile, because that's what I did for some years. So that I had fun writing that part of it. So there's a more personal aspect. I mean, black holes seem rather remote and impersonal and austere. I tried in the book to make them more approachable by talking more about the stories of how they were discovered and the people who did it and the challenges they had to overcome, and some even of my challenges in trying to study these objects over the years.
Did you ever get to work with or meet Hawking?
I did when I was younger. I'm a Brit, actually, by origin, so I was an undergraduate in London and a grad student in Edinburgh. And when I was a grad student, I met him. Dankler went down to Cambridge to work for a while, and he's always surrounded by fans and students that want to work with him or just listen to what he had to say. This was before he lost all his speech. He just had the tail end of his speech, and he had a translator. So that was fascinating to see him. And I met him briefly after a couple of symposia, also when I was a postdoc. Yeah, he's larger than life in my world, for sure, as in the larger world when he became famous.
Are you already working on another book?
No, I'm taking a breather because it's hard to write a book. So I've done it 8 times now, and I don't know if it gets easier. Maybe a little. So I'm, still looking at my next idea. I do have an idea, though. I mean, the one I'm pushing or working hard on is the story of the elements, the astrophysical story of the elements. Where do the elements come from? You know, the trope, we're all made of stardust and so on, which is true. There's some amazing astrophysics and physics associated with where the periodic table comes from and the journeys of those elements in and out of stars and between galaxies to end up in our bodies for a short period of time. It's a bizarre, amazing story. So I think that's the story I want to tell next.
So, look for that in a couple of years?
Yeah, a couple of years. Yeah, it takes more than a year to write a book, so it won't be for less than a year.
Well, this is a great book, and we didn't talk a lot about the stories, although we did some. But listeners, if you like science and you like physics, this is going to be a real treasure for you, and it'll be out in November, and it's a good holiday gift-giving book for people who like space and physics, might be a way to give them a nice gift. Einstein's Monsters and Dr. Chris Impey, The Life and Times of Black Holes. It's been great talking to you again on the show, and I look forward to more programs with you. You're a fascinating guy with a lot of great knowledge and a good way to teach it to all of us. So we thank you for being with us.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, and there were great questions, good discussion. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Okay, and I will archive and send you all the information either later tonight or tomorrow. And listeners, that's it. So look at our schedule for the rest of the week on the Space Show. And we look forward to your participation there, too. So on behalf of Chris, myself, and the Space Show, everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep looking up, and goodbye. Everybody, listen to the rest of our programs. We have some good ones coming up this week.